Well, we are talking about game cooking, wildlife-related travel, hunting, and much more today. Hi, this is Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry. Scott Craven is back in the studio with us. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. And in a few minutes, actually, Dan Small from Outdoor Wisconsin will be joining us to talk about his upcoming hunting special. Do you have questions about game cooking? What's your favorite place to travel to see wildlife? Join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at wpr.org. And of course, you can always post on our Facebook page. You'll find it at The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Well, good to see you, Scott.
Good to be here, as always.
So what's this about you and Larry having a cookbook about wild game?
That goes back quite a bit in history. When I first started on the job and got to know Larry, and that was back in the 70s, late 70s, 80s and whatnot, we figured out that we shared a common interest in hunting, the outdoors, and cooking. And ended up, at that point, Extension was sponsoring lots of kind of outreach courses and whatnot. So we lined up a couple local demonstration kitchens in some of the schools and offered a game cooking class. And it was very well received. We got some great people in there. And at that point in history, it was a little easier to get materials from various sources, like the DNR, from sometimes confiscated materials and whatnot for educational purposes. And we cooked a lot of geese and pheasants and deer and oddball stuff that most people might more likely consider roadkill, like raccoons and possums and whatnot. But we came up with some terrific recipes that people were bringing in, and they really got into the spirit of things, and they'd bring a bottle of wine and tablecloths, and we'd have a grand time. And Larry and I learned a lot from it, too, and the result of that was a little Extension cookbook that came out a few years after the class called Enjoying the Harvest. And it talked about the basics of nutritional content of game meat versus domestic equivalents. And a lot of really neat recipes. And it's, I think it's still out there with Extension. I'm not sure. I've still got a couple copies, but I'm falling further and further out of the loop. But Larry and I discussed last year reinstating the class and teaching a new class at a beautiful demonstration kitchen that's been built over in Verona. So we'll see how that comes out.
Well, I would think that would be very well received again.
I think it'd be fun, too.
Yeah.
So Larry's excited about it, and I think you saw that picture of what Larry looked like at one of the classes.
That's
right.
That
was 40 years ago, so times have changed.
Scott brought in a newspaper clipping that was in, I'm not sure exactly which newspaper, but it was from 1987. It was a picture of Larry and with some of the things that he prepared with Scott. For that. So it was, I actually tried to get it on our Facebook page, but I couldn't get it to work. So
there's a pretty funny backstory to that picture, actually.
Oh, really?
Because when you look at the picture, you'll notice you can only see one of his hands.
Okay.
The other hand is under the table with a big bandage on the thumb because when we were cutting up the pheasant for that sweet and sour pheasant dish he was featuring in the picture, he managed to perforate his thumb.
Oh.
And it was all bandaged up and hidden from view. But even the pros make a mistake now and then.
That's right. First rule in the kitchen, watch the knives. So what is the most important thing for us to know when we're preparing game?
That's a good question. There are quite a few, actually. I think the first consideration is that a really nice presentation of a game dish, any game dish, whether it's venison, pheasant, turkey, whatever, starts in the field at the point of harvest. So the animal in question, no matter what it is, needs to be properly field dressed, transported, refrigerated, and ultimately prepared back home for the freezer or for immediate eating. And that means making sure that all of the feathers, dirt, other contamination, shot pellets in the meat, especially now that with waterfowl and even with some other birds, people are using steel shot. For the uninitiated game eater to chomp on a lead shot pellet, there's a little bit of give. There's no give with steel shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to get that shot out and any bone fragments or other things so that what you put on the table, regardless of the recipe, is technically sound, not You know, you don't want to serve a venison stew with lots of those hollow white hairs floating around in the gravy.
Not appetizing.
Appetizing at all. So I think good field care and preparation techniques carry the day. At that point, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of good game cookbooks now. Every game association, club, church group, and everything has, favorite game recipes of the, East Taylor County something or other.
Sure.
Plus, there are lots of commercial ones ranging from the L.L. Bean cookbook to lots of other ones. My favorite is one called After the Hunt, which was produced by an author and a company in Louisiana. It's huge. The book weighs about 30 pounds, literally.
Oh my.
But it's beautifully illustrated in color. You can find it on Amazon. And it starts with a history of hunting in the United States and then goes through all sorts of recipes and a lot of interesting side dishes. If there's one cultural group in the country that can really cook, it's the Cajuns in South Louisiana.
Yes,
and they have a lot of game down there. So there's everything from gator recipes to crawfish to the traditional things we have here. So a good recipe, a good product brought from the field, and proper cooking technique. And I guess on that note, the only other thing I'd add is, generally speaking, if you overcook game meat, you're going to be really disappointed in the product. It gets really tough. So, especially with things like venison or a goose breast fillet or something, don't overcook them.
So, if someone has a favorite recipe, like, maybe for turkey or chicken, and they have a goose, is it advisable to use that recipe, or should you really look for a special recipe?
Depends a little bit on what you have. There's a lot of interchangeability. So, for example, with a boneless, skinless pheasant breast, that visually you can hardly distinguish it from a boneless, skinless chicken breast, you could use virtually any favorite chicken recipe. Same thing for venison cuts and probably beef, although there's a little more flavor differential there. So you can use the standard stuff. The only caution I'd say there is that for the average hunter, you just don't get very many turkeys or very many geese or very many pheasants. So if you're trying to share this with the family for the first time or neighbors or friends or whatnot, pick a recipe that features the meat so you can tell what it is. It's not concealed. For example, I've got a goose. I like chili. I'll grind up this goose and turn it into chili.
Interesting.
Well, you can do that to stretch your meat budget or whatever, but it so conceals the quality and inherent qualities of that particular game meat that I think that's a tactical error.
Okay, well, great. That's great advice. Now let's go to the phone because we've got Mike in St. Lawrence, and he's got a comment for us. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Well, what's your comment?
Well, I just I like the venison stew recipe in the first of all, let me say I've got the original Wild Game Cooking.
That's Remington, isn't it?
And Larry Mueller.
Oh, from Larry, okay.
So both of you. You're both.
Oh, okay.
He forgot the name.
And it's autographed, Best Wishes by Larry Mueller.
Wow. That's a collector's
so
item, Mike.
I call and show, and I probably pledged some money, and they sent me a cookbook.
Probably. Well, thank you.
Yeah, and my favorite recipe in there is a venison stew, and I make venison chili, but I had two or three cans of beans, different black beans and kidney beans, and then I put in some chopped red peppers and yellow peppers, and It spices it up a little bit, and it's pretty good. So, but I've been using it for years and years and years and years.
Oh, good. Thanks for calling. It's neat to know that it's still out there.
Yeah. All right.
In answer to your earlier question, one of the things that I've been doing, I found a recipe in the Food Network magazine the other day that was a turkey pie.
Okay.
And a lot of those have different types of crust, but the topping of this one is a chive cornmeal biscuit.
Oh, yum.
And they get really crunchy. They're drop biscuits on top of the basic pot pie mix, and those biscuits are fantastic. So I've been making it with either pheasant or wild turkey or a mix of both. And holy cow, the family just goes nuts over that. So you can adapt many common recipes to use your game meat, and it comes out pretty good.
Just like a lot of people do with regular recipes,
yes.
Right? Yeah,
yep.
Make them your own.
And if there's something you like better, some people will like mushrooms in their stew, some people won't. A venison stew is pretty difficult to mess up.
Okay.
A little bit of wine, the vegetables you like, and I find that fresh thyme is a really nice spice for a venison stew, and you're off and running.
Okay, great. Well, speaking of venison, I think Dennis in Green Bay has a question about that. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I've always been told that venison should hang a certain amount of time, you know, 3, 5, 7 days, whatever. Is there any truth to that?
You've picked the scab off an awful wound. The debate rages on in the hunting community about aging venison. I've got friends who, you know, will go to their grave saying, no, it's not necessary, and others say, well, it's absolutely necessary. The ones who are real proponents of aging usually have the facilities or the capability of doing it right, and that means hanging the animal in cold storage, the way a meat processor could do it, under controlled temperature, humidity, no contamination, no problems. And that's fine, especially for an older animal, and it would benefit from aging. But a lot of the animals taken in Wisconsin are yearlings or even fawns. And for a while, the vast majority of our buck harvest were yearling bucks. Those animals are only 18 months old and probably would not benefit greatly from aging. Now, if you get a big old 12-pointer that, we don't go to the registration stations anymore, but somebody who knows what they're doing looks at the teeth and says, holy cow, that guy's 9.5 years old. That animal would probably benefit from aging, and if not aging, at least special handling in the cooking process. The problem with aging for the average person like you and I is where the heck are you going to put the deer? I hang it in my outbuilding, and the temperature, especially a year like this, if things don't change pretty quickly, we could have 60-degree temperatures for the deer season, and that is very bad for aging. Your probability of really essentially wasting your animal by aging under warm conditions is great. In addition, you know, an animal hanging in the backyard or in the barn, the cats get after it, the dog chews off a piece, it's too hot, it's too cold, or it gets too cold, it freezes solid, then you have trouble cutting it up. I just think the risk for the average person greatly exceeds the reward. And if you handle the carcass otherwise properly, or have somebody who knows what they're doing age it, you're okay. Otherwise, too risky.
All right. Well, I think that was great information for you, Dennis. Good luck with that. Barb in River Falls emailed, and she wants to know, how do you cook Canada goose so that it's edible? Apparently, she's had some bad
experience. Yeah, I cooked one of the first ones I harvested in Wisconsin. My mother-in-law was visiting. This was years ago, and I thought, well, most people think about you want a beautiful presentation of a whole roast bird.
Sure.
So I roasted the whole bird, and it's done. Took it out of the oven, and I'm going to carve it. So I hit that breast tissue with a fork, and it bounced back just like I'd hit a basketball. That was a case of an old bird.
Okay.
And there are ways you can tell the age of these animals, but that's probably another program.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've gone with most game birds, pheasants, turkeys, geese. First thing I do is fillet out the breast. So you end up with a boneless fillet. If you really want it wrapped in skin for your presentation or cooking, you can just go to your local meat cutter and say, hey, if you're processing chickens, can I have a half a pound of skin?
Okay.
Or
you
can buy your own carcass and just save the chicken skin or turkey skin. Wrap your game equivalent with domestic skin, toothpick it in place. It'll be fine.
Okay.
If you don't skin the bird, you run the risk of the skin hiding some of those problems I mentioned earlier, like feather tracts where the shot carries feathers into the meat, the shot itself, a bone fragment, whatever. So that's one issue.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can cook the breast meat the way you want it, and you can do all sorts of things with it. If you try and cook the legs, especially of a turkey, with the breast meat, that's a real challenge. Same thing with a pheasant. The tendons are problematic, and those birds like to run. The legs are going to be almost impenetrable, and cooking them at the same time, it's just counterproductive,
right,
in my opinion. So I do something with the breast fillets. I do something else with the legs. And in the case of pheasants, where the legs aren't that big, I'll save those on the side. When I have 6 or 8 of them accumulated, I'll cook those for a couple hours in a crock pot or on the stove, and then bone out that meat and use it for a pot pie, a wild rice soup, or something like that. And the breast meat you can do for an elegant presentation or whatever the heck you want.
Okay. Well, and I think a lot of expert cooks say the same thing about even a domesticated turkey, too.
Right.
So, all right. Well, our guest is Scott Craven. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Do you have any questions about cooking game or hunting? Because, well, Dan Small's going to be up in a little bit, so you can ask him, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe, and I'm sitting in for Larry today. Scott Craven is our guest, but we also have Dan Small on the line. He's out turkey hunting. Dan is the host and producer of the public television show Outdoor Wisconsin and Outdoors Radio with Dan Small and a contributing editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jill. Hi, Scott. Can you hear me okay?
We
can. Just fine. Just fine. Did you get a turkey?
Not yet. I'm sitting in a cedar grove somewhere in Manitowoc County. My friend John Freis, who's the founder of the American Wild Turkey Hunting Dog Association, he's somewhere within 40 acres of me, and his dog, Lucky, is running circles around us. And if she barks and flushes some birds, then we're going to try to call him back. But no luck so far.
Okay.
Well, if you disappear suddenly, we'll understand what's going on.
Yes.
If you hear a shot, you'll know that, I got lucky here. This high-tech hunting is amazing. I've got a 4G signal. I've been listening to you guys on my WPR smartphone app, and there's Lucky barking, so we'll see what happens.
Uh-oh, we may lose him. Well, before you get your turkey, Dan, why don't you tell us about your new next show? You got a pretty big anniversary coming up here.
That's right. For the past, this is the 25th year, we have done, and I say we, that is Milwaukee PBS and the DNR have teamed up, and in the last 5 years I've done it with my friend Mark LaBarbera to produce a show that we call Deer Hunt Wisconsin, and then we tag the year on it. So this is Deer Hunt Wisconsin 2016. It's the 25th anniversary, and it airs tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on Milwaukee PBS, that's channel 10, and on the Wisconsin Public TV digital channel, that's the Wisconsin channel, so that's the 21.2 and so on around the state. And it's going to cover new regulations. There are some big changes, as I'm sure Scott knows and a lot of listeners know. There are no more back tags this year, and your carcass tags are printed on paper, and there's a new electronic registration process that really was launched last year, but if you didn't get a deer last year, maybe you didn't have to use that. And we're going to be talking with DNR officials, Kevin Wallenfang and Bob Knack with the Big Game Program, about the County Deer Advisory Councils, electronic registration, and a lot of other things. And we've got a couple of new hunters on the show. I won't tell you too much about it, except they've got some exciting stories to share.
Oh, and, you've been doing this for 25 years, so how hard is it to get new stories for each one of these?
Well, with 600,000 to 700,000 deer hunters in the state, there are stories galore. And the challenge is finding a couple of people who are willing to talk on camera and who've got a recent success story or a how I got into hunting story, and we've got one of each of those. That's not too difficult. And, of course, the DNR folks are busy developing the new rules, whatever they happen to be for the year, and then implementing them. And the challenge there is getting the interviews done in time so that we can get the show edited and get it approved by PBS so it gets on the air. And we finished editing this show Monday at 11 o'clock.
Wow.
Put a hard drive. We were working in Crawford County at a friend's place because my editor, who lives up in Eau Claire, had his house flooded and during that storm in September. So we're working without internet, and we put the drive. He drove to Madison, put the drive on a bus to get it to Milwaukee by 5 p.m. Monday, and it got ingested into the system, and closed captioned and all that technical stuff that people don't really care about or know about. And as I understand it, it's uplinked and it's going to air. So I think,
Dan, I was looking at the website this morning that there are 7 or 8 snippets or individual segments that are already up on the DNR website as YouTube videos that people can look at.
That's right. Part of our arrangement with the DNR was to produce 5 new segments back in August and September, primarily about antlerless tags, where to hunt, and electronic registration, and also the Snapshot Wisconsin program. So those are already there, and all you need to do is go to the DNR website, which is dnr.wi.gov, and then type in the keywords deer show, and you'll see those videos. And within a week or so, we'll have all the segments from this year's show on that site as well, and also on the Deer Hunt Wisconsin YouTube channel, which I maintain, and that that has last year's stuff on it. It doesn't have this year's segments yet. But the show's going to air on Public tomorrow night, and then it repeats on Saturday morning on Milwaukee PBS. And then next week, Thursday night, we're on Fox Sports North and Fox Sports Wisconsin. It's 9 p.m. on Fox Sports North, which is covering the northern part of Wisconsin and the Dakotas, Minnesota, and northern Iowa. And then at 10 p.m. on Fox Sports Wisconsin, and it also repeats several times on the weekend on both of those networks. And then on Saturday, November 12th at 6 a.m., it's going to air on Fox 47, in the Madison area. Now, I know you can't remember all that, but all of that is on it's on the Deer Show page on the DNR website.
And you also have a Facebook page too, don't you?
Yes, the Deer Hunt Wisconsin Facebook page as well. Yep.
And that'll be there also?
The information, if it's not there, I think, I don't know if we've updated it, but it will be there tonight when I get home, get out of the woods.
You don't want to do it from where you are now?
I'm lucky I can listen to your show and talk on the phone. We did Keith Warnke and I did a live Facebook stream at a gun range at the North Bristol Sportsman's Club. And I said, bring somebody who knows how to do this. So I was sighting in a rifle, and we fed it live to Facebook. And by that evening, we had hundreds of hits. I think within 2 days he had almost 2,000 hits, and he said, we got to do this again. I said, yeah, it seems to be where it's at, because people really they respond to this social media, and the digital age has us all doing this, even though some of us had to get dragged into it kicking and screaming.
Yes, it's a good thing for everybody, I think. So
yes.
So what are your predictions for the deer hunt this year? Do you think it's going to be a good one?
Well, it's weather dependent, and it's where are you in the state dependent. The deer herd is good. It's very strong in the southern part of the state and the central farmland. Deer up north are less abundant because we've had, last winter was okay, but the winter before was pretty severe, and that's one of the things the biologists are going to talk about. They're going to give us a forecast for each of the regions. And it's bucks only in, 10 or 12 counties. I've forgotten exactly how many. So in some areas of the state, you might see a doe but not be able to shoot it, and you might not see that buck that you're hoping to shoot. But, where I live in Vernon County, there are deer all over the place. I've already picked up 2 roadkills, and I've seen more that I didn't know how fresh they were and didn't have time to deal with them. I think there are a lot of deer in the state. Bow hunters are taking some really nice deer, and with last year's mild winter, the effect on bucks is that they can put more of that nutrition that they, instead of replenishing their body fat and so on, they put it into antler growth. And there's some really nice nice racks on deer that I've seen. One of my young friends shot a really nice buck and brought it by the other day. And so I'm encouraged. I'm optimistic.
Okay. Well, our weather guys were in the other day, and they said it's supposed to drop down to near freezing for deer hunting season. So you guys can look forward to that. Yeah. We did put a link to the deer hunt page, the DNR deer hunt page, on our Facebook page. So if anybody wants to go there, they can link directly to that from the Larry Mueller Facebook page. So, Dan, I know you're hunting, so I think we should probably let you go and enjoy that.
Okay, well, one more thing I forgot. The show will also be on community broadcast stations all over the state. Probably in the next week or 10 days, we'll get them an hour-long version. So folks can just check their local community access or public access station. It'll probably air a total of, hundreds of times. So no excuse for not getting that information. Lots of opportunities to watch it. So thanks so much for giving me a few minutes, and I enjoyed you listening to you talk about cooking. It makes me hungry.
Time for lunch. All right, thanks,
yeah,
Dan.
Cool.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Bye. All right, well, you know, we're going to be taking more phone calls. And since we're talking about deer, let's talk to Mike in West Bend. He has a question for us. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Listen, I have a question. I have a place in the western UP, but I look at the difference between Michigan and Wisconsin. You never hear this addressed. You won't see it on these deer shows. It's all about habitat. And I want to know if Mr. Craven, if he is aware of how well this new program is where the state is offering their foresters to help out the feds take care of the Shawamig and Nicolet, which is just a mess. And without winter habitat, these deer just can't get through the winters. And the winter habitat is the key. I want to know what his thoughts on that was.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. Without appropriate habitat, none of these animals, from songbirds and voles to deer, bears, and wolves, will be able to thrive. So habitat management is critical. And when you start talking about big blocks of habitat, like our national forests or even the state or county forests, those become particularly critical. So as the amount of timber harvest, which is important in terms of creating young successional forests that are important to a lot of species, as that has scaled back, especially on some of the national forests for a variety of reasons, that things have, as you suggested, on the habitat front, probably deteriorated a bit. But the offering of this cooperative agreement, if the on the Fed side they're shorthanded, the offer to provide some state expertise in a collaborative nature for the good of habitat in general in the state is a good idea. And as far as I know, it seems to be working out. How much the landscape has actually been impacted or changed, I can't say. But in theory, the whole idea is a good one. So, and habitat is certainly critical.
So are you talking about when loggers come in and do clear cut and they leave nothing for the animals to eat or to hide in or nest in?
Actually,
is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, but actually that's a good thing.
For
at least the short period after a clear cut, especially in aspen, it looks like it was hit with a bomb.
Right.
But that stuff, particularly the aspen, regenerates very quickly, very quickly. And even a year to 3 years post-harvest, you end up with this dense tangle and jungle of young aspen trees, which are very important to a whole variety of species, including deer, some songbirds, woodcock and grouse, and so on. So it's not a matter of all clear-cutting. There are various types of timber harvest strategies. But that one is one that, although it sometimes looks bad to a passerby, in reality, the benefits are long-term and very positive.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for that question, Mike. That was great. We appreciate that. Now, let's go back to cooking a little bit. We have a few more people with questions. Jim emailed to ask how to cook a woodcock. Apparently, he doesn't care for liver too much, and this bird tastes at least that bad or worse.
Well, woodcock are kind of a strange one when it comes to game cooking because they are very often likened to both the texture and taste of liver. Now, some people like liver, and they're probably very fond of woodcock. Mind you, a woodcock's a small bird. So there's not much to deal with there as far as leg. So it's a matter of the breast fillet, which is a chunk of meat about that size. The listeners can't see that, but at best, 50-cent piece size.
Maybe 2 quarters.
Maybe 2 quarters. A woodcock's a little bit bigger than a dove, but I tend to do them the same way. Dove breasts whole on a shish kebab, for example, with some vegetables and a little teriyaki sauce are pretty good. On the woodcock front, you can split those breasts crosswise and get 2 chunks of meat out of each breast fillet. And same thing there. I think to camouflage them a little bit for the non-liver lovers, take that chunk of woodcock breast. Someone else asked about marinating. They're prime candidates for a good marinade. A strong acid like lemon juice or something like that, along with a bit of wine, some herbs and whatnot. Take them out of that. Put them on a toothpick with a piece of water chestnut or a chunk of jalapeno pepper or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Wrap it in
skin?
Bacon.
Bacon. Oh,
wrap
God.
It in bacon, a little bit of teriyaki or barbecue sauce, and on the grill until they're quickly cooked. Good might be appropriate statement, but that's one way to do it and kind of get away from the dominating flavor of liver.
So if they're not great and you have to go through all that work for one little tiny piece of meat, what's the attraction for you? Yeah.
Well, they're a lot of fun to hunt. The way they flush, first of all, they're really only available for kind of a short window in the Northwoods, usually around the middle of October when the northern flight comes through. It's very much weather dependent. We get a cold front that brings them in, and all of a sudden these young aspen stands and alder stands and other preferred habitat will be full of woodcock. And then another cold front comes through a week later, and they're gone. So when they're there, they can be very abundant. They're very sporting in terms of the way they flush and twitter and fly off through the cover. It's just kind of a traditional upland bird hunting type in the fall, which is a side or a benefit, or say an add-on to grouse hunting,
okay,
which are the glamour bird in the Northwoods. You can only harvest 3 woodcock a day. So you're looking at best, 6 of those little chunks of meat. So if you're going to feed the family, you need to go 2, 3, 4 days before you've accumulated enough for them to be the star of the meal.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the hors d'oeuvre idea of wrapped in bacon and on the grill as a starter for a meal is probably a little better.
Sounds like a great
idea.
But
they are very popular for the short window of time that they're here.
Our guest is Scott Craven. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Do you have questions about wildlife? You can give us a call. We've got some lines open. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Doc. He's in Big Cedar Lake. Hi, Doc. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We can.
I just want to comment that the average hunter leaves the best part of the deer in the woods, and that is les abats, the heart, liver, and kidneys. I was in Wyoming a week and a half ago with my son and grandson, and they took 2 nice antelope, and that night I prepared antelope kidneys. I prepared rognon flamme à la madère. In other words, it's a French recipe. I cubed the kidneys, sautéed them in butter briefly, certainly not overcooking them, and then poured in brandy, and then turned out the lights in the kitchen and lit the pan.
Oh, my.
you see, in the 50s, I was stationed in France, and I belonged to a French hunting and fishing club, and oh, my goodness, I learned so much there. Before I hang up, I want to say that the great woodcock connoisseurs would roast the birds without removing the entrails. So that's just what I wanted to say.
Okay. Well, you know, the kind of elegant presentation you describe, I suspect, is quite good, but also probably beyond the expertise of interest of some of our mainline hunters. my mentor here in Wisconsin, you know, 30 years ago in deer camp, there was some question when I first joined the deer camp. Hey, what about the, my dad used to save the heart and liver and so forth back in New England. And the comment of my mentor here and kind of the head of that deer camp is, we don't worry about what grows in the dark. So internal organs, internal organs were left with the entrails in the woods for the chickadees and possums and fox to dine on. The other issue that makes some people fidgety about organs, especially liver, you know, propensity for liver flukes and other such things that diminish the dining experience, or at least the risk thereof. So if you have that level of expertise and culinary training, you can do lots of things with lots of cuts or species or parts thereof that are sometimes ignored. But for
and
the
if
most
you
part,
give it a French name, it's going to sound pretty darn good.
If you
good.
Give it a French name and set it on fire in the dark, people are probably
they're
going to be
eat
impressed.
It. Absolutely. Yep. All right. Well, you know, we were talking earlier with Dan Small about the deer hunt, and I think you had some comments that you wanted to give.
Well, just a couple other things I wanted sure. to add to the discussion for people to consider. It's, you know, there'll be over 600,000 people out
That's a
there
lot of
2 people.
Weeks
from this Saturday. It's a lot of people, so a lot of people have a dog in the fight, so to speak. Just a couple of thoughts to consider. First of all, the DNR website that we mentioned and Dan gave the address is really the go-to source for the many rule changes that are in play, a variety of meetings coming up where there are opportunities for public input, like the new chronic wasting disease task force that met a couple days ago and will meet again on November, where are my notes here, November 14th, I believe it is. And I'll say more about that in a moment. All the season frameworks, the hours, the permit availability, there are still antlerless permits available for many of the counties, and so people still have that opportunity. It's basically, I think, the go-to tool for this to find out what counties, for example, have feeding and baiting bans, stuff that if you don't pay attention to it as a hunter, you can get crosswise with the law, which you don't want. That will really diminish your hunting experience.
It certainly will.
In addition, there'll be chronic wasting disease sampling for deer in some new counties, particularly Oneida, Vilas, and Florence, and Oconto in the east central part of the state. And the second year of CWD sampling in Marquette and Green Lake counties, and then all the usual suspects in the southern tiers of counties where CWD has been present for quite a while. I guess I bring that up if people want to have their animals tested for their own peace of mind, but also to make sure you get enough samples into the pool so that the DNR can draw some conclusions about what's going on in those counties. There will be an online chat with DNR people on November 10th. You can find that on the website. Yeah, the second CWD meeting that I mentioned is the 14th at 9:30 in the morning at the Lussier Family Center here in Monona, right off the Beltline, and there can be public input at that. We mentioned Deer Hunt 2016. That's on, but there's also a fact sheet on the DNR website called Deer Hunt 2016 that provides a quick and easy reference for all these regulation changes. There's also a game registration tutorial about the online registration and another quick fact sheet on finding a place to hunt. And there are some big changes this year with the back tags disappearing. The presence of blaze pink in the woods potentially is one that just baffles me. I just don't find I'm involved in a national hunting awareness program with lots of women hunters, and I can't find a one of them that does anything but roll her eyes and say, what the heck are they thinking with this pink? They're quite comfortable and happy with the safety values of orange. But nevertheless, it's now
yep.
available, so
it
if you like
is.
It, make a fashion statement and head out. I thought about getting a pink vest, but we'll see how it goes.
I think you look very smart in that, Scott.
Probably so. So the bottom line is there's lots going on with the deer season. There'll be lots of people out there. The opportunity should be great this year, so go forth and have a good hunt and be safe.
Absolutely. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. Scott Craven is our guest. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. What questions do you have about wildlife? Are you planning on going on a trip to see wildlife? We'd like to hear about it, and we're going to give you some information about some coming up. So give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, coming up at 2 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will discuss the pros and cons of how our public schools are funded. But right now, we're talking about wildlife with Scott Craven. And Scott, before we go back to the phones, you were telling me about a trip that you're going to be leading coming up soon. What was that about?
Well, last year on the program at about, well, it was a little earlier than this in the season, we talked about a trip that I was co-leading with a good friend of mine who runs a kind of a nature and outdoor adventure travel service out of Door County. And Paul and I took a trip up to Isle Royale with a group of, I think it was 16 people, and just had a wonderful time. And this year, our opportunity is entitled Discovering Florida Wildlife, and it'll run from January 22nd to 27th. And we'll be based out of Fort Myers, but spending most of our time down in the Everglades, in Everglades City, in Shark Valley, and a couple of other spots there, looking at wildlife and hiking around in some really interesting country. Especially interesting because I know on January 22nd it will be quite a bit warmer there than it will be here.
Or Isle
so,
Royale.
the key thing with these trips is, and particularly the lineup of trips available this year, is that they're run in conjunction with and sponsored by the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. And the foundation supports a wide variety of conservation, land management, and educational programs throughout the state. It's a great group, very important for conservation in Wisconsin. And they derive some additional support from these trips. The last time I checked, the Florida Wildlife Tour only had a couple slots open. I think there are only 12 or 14 people going along for that one, or the trip to Patagonia, Panama. Now, the Florida one's the only one I'm involved with this year, but they're also involved with trips to Patagonia, Panama in February, birding the Texas North Coast in April, a safari in Tanzania on the Serengeti in August, and another trip to the parks of the Canadian Northern Rockies in September, which I might be involved with. That's to be determined. In any event, if people want information on any of these, they can contact the foundation. They can go to www.wisconservation.org and find out some information there, or the contact person at the foundation is Michelle Milford. And it's worth looking into. If you like getting out and seeing these things, there are a lot of great places in the country to go watch wildlife, and a couple of them are featured here.
Certainly are. That sounds like a really good time. Well, let's go back to the phones, and we've got Willie from Steuben. Hi, Willie. What's your question for us?
Hey, well, I don't really have a question. I just heard, I love Scott Craven. I do not miss this show.
Well, that's great. We do,
okay.
Too.
Okay. Well, I was driving to the end of my driveway the other day, and I saw a huge beep bear, really big bear. I get the basketball dial, little plug for that, paper, and they always say, oh, it was a 200 or 300-pound bear that somebody shot up north. This thing was down in Steuben, and I grew up on a farm, and I know what a 500-pound calf looked like. And this thing was 500 pounds, and it was huge. And
wow.
I'm just wondering about the bear population. I read also in the Boswell Dial that in this bear season we shot 4,000 and like 300 bear.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. I mean, I didn't even know that there was that many bear here, and now they're moving down south, and it's a really big one. And a lot of people have got this bear on their game camps, trail camps, and it's gone from Eastman. I'm sure you're not familiar with Crawford County, but it's gone from Eastman to Bell Center, the same bear, and it's really big. I'm just asking how the bear population is moving south or how that goes.
Well, Willie, thanks for the kind words, and I'll just say that you were right on a number of counts. The bear population, and not the population necessarily, but individual bears are clearly moving south. There are more and more sightings on trail cameras all the time. In fact, one of my buddies on the farm that I hunt in Iowa County, not 25 miles west of Madison here, sent me a picture last week from my son's deer stand, and there was the south end of a large bear going north about 50 yards from where my son sits during the deer season. And we just don't see many bears out in that country. So, yes, they're around, and they do seem to be becoming certainly much more frequent in the central part of the state and even in some of the southern counties. The bear population in general is doing very well. I think the last population estimate that I saw prior to the bear season was something like 28,500 animals, which is a lot of bears. The harvest, as you suggested, was between 4,000 and 5,000. It usually is. And there are always some 500 or 600-pound bears taken within that harvest. Now, certainly most of them are smaller than that, but there are some bears that push 500 or 600 pounds or even a little over 600 pounds, and those are big animals. Interestingly enough, Wisconsin apparently, at least the last time the statistics were out, is the leading bear harvest state in the country, including Alaska, interestingly enough. So, yes, there are a lot of bears. The bear harvest is strong. Interest in hunting bears, either with dogs or with bait, is also strong. And there are kind of two separate groups or opportunities there within the bear hunting community. And there you have it.
All right.
That's the bear situation in a nutshell.
It certainly is.
Well, and on this, I just wanted to go back.
Sure.
One other thing, when we were talking about woodcock, there's another interesting phenomenon involving those birds, and it's that most hunting dogs will not pick them up, even very well-trained retrievers.
Because they don't like the taste either?
I don't know. I've not been able to interview the dogs, but they'll often come over and sniff them or pick them up and quickly go, pooey, and spit them out. So that leads me to believe that there's something there that suggests that their culinary opportunities are
limited.
Maybe more limited than some other birds.
All right. Well, good to know. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jim in Colfax. Hi, Jim. What's your question?
Well, The other crazy caller says, I love, not crazy that way, crazy about this show. I love hearing from you, Scott. It's fun to learn your knowledge. I posted a picture. I hope it's coming through. I tried it twice. I've never uploaded a photo to Facebook, but I uploaded a picture of a bobcat. It had to be at least 50 pounds or more. I'm in Dunn County. I'm south of 64, only a mile, in about 10 miles east of Highway 25. I've had several trail cameras in the past, not several, but a few, of bobcats up in the northern part of Dunn County. The unique thing was sitting in the tree stand, which I'm out there, very avid hunter, so seeing a bobcat in the wild was pretty cool. It's the first time, I've seen one as a child, but first time I've ever seen it in the wild. Came through, first a small buck came through, kept looking behind, and turning around, I thought, oh boy, here comes my trophy. And he'd move 10 yards and look behind. He'd move 10 yards, look behind, and all of a sudden, here comes the bobcat and stopped and stared at me. And I got lucky enough to grab the phone out of my pocket and put the archery equipment down and got his picture. My question is, I didn't know that bobcats would necessarily go after a white-tailed deer. And the size of this guy was definitely the size of a wolf, much bigger than a coyote. I hope the picture comes through. And I just want some comments about
well,
after a deer.
I think it did. The picture came through. If I'm looking at the right picture from a bit of a distance here, it's a big cat, and it looks like it was kind of up a ridge from you.
Exactly, 20 yards.
Okay.
Yep, I'm 20 yards below the ridge.
Good. All right, so that's the right picture. I'm just far enough from it that with my failing eyesight, I can't look at it very closely. But, I mean, it looks like certainly a good-sized cat. They're pretty furry. So, I mean, 50 pounds weight-wise, that would be a monster. I'm not sure that's but at the upper limit that they might get to be. But what I wanted to look at closely was the animal itself. It's It's certainly not
a little fuzzy.
It's certainly not a cougar. Anyway, I'll take a closer look at it here as we take a news break here before long and come back on and offer some thoughts. But to your question about was it pursuing the deer, if it was following the trail, its intentions will remain unclear since we have no information on that. But bobcats are considered and listed to be one of many predators that will take deer on occasion, but not certainly at the level as wolves and coyotes and bears, especially, which are very effective predators on fawns. For a bobcat to take down a healthy adult deer, pursue it and take it down would be a little unusual, but could happen.
He just maybe has a good attitude.
He's got a positive can-do attitude,
can-do attitude,
apparently.
That's right. All right, well, let's go back to the phones then. Thanks for your call, Jim. And we got Mike from Cushing. Hi, Mike.
Hello. My question is, this year, none of my oak trees, my walnut tree, did not have any nuts. Last year was like walking on marbles. This year, I haven't seen a single walnut in my oak grove. I mean, acorn in my oak grove.
Well, I'm glad you said acorn, not walnut.
It was a complete bust for acorns in a lot of parts of the state. And acorns of the various woodland crops, acorns are probably the most valuable single food production source for wildlife. So having a bummer of an acorn crop is a real problem for a lot of species. Hopefully they'll find something else, but it was a bad year for acorns, a bad year for walnuts in some areas, and for some growers, a bad year for apples. I lost all of my apple crop with a late frost last spring. There were other people who had a good harvest. So anyway, the lack of those wild foodstuffs is a problem for wildlife, and it's pretty widespread in a lot of the state.
Do you think that has something to do with the trees being stressed or not stressed?
I think it has everything to do with when the frost was timed.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. All right. Well, thank you very much for your call, Mike. And hopefully we'll have some better acorn crops next year for our wildlife. We've been talking with Scott Craven. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. What wildlife questions do you have? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And of course, you can always post on our Facebook page, and we love to see your picture. So if you have a picture of something that you'd like Scott to identify, put it up there. We'll be back after the news. Well, it's the first Wednesday of the month, so that means we're talking about wildlife. Hi, Jill Nadeau here. I'm filling in for Larry today. We're glad to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven is with us. Again, he is our emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. What questions about wildlife do you have for Scott? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And of course, you can always post on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show. And let's go to the phones right away, Scott. We've got Mark in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mark. What's your question?
Good afternoon. I have kind of a combination of two questions. One is there any research, or has the DNR done any research on food plots? And my situation is I have 160 acres kind of between the Dells and Briggsville. And of that 160, approximately 80 acres of it is agricultural, which I lease out. My son has been badgering me, for lack of a better word, to install a food plot. He claims it will hold deer better. He says there's mixes that increases the size of the rack and the quality of deer. Yes, we have tried quality managing hunting, which over the last 10 years we've seen some success. But specifically, I don't know if it's worth the work and the time, because we've got corn, we have soybeans, we have alfalfa all the way around us. Would a food plot be beneficial? And I'll take my answer off the air, if you don't mind.
Okay, thank you, Mark. What do you think, Scott?
If you're in an agricultural matrix, the animals probably have enough food, but I think your son is probably right that a well-positioned food plot especially if you're doing any bow or crossbow hunting, where your stands are positioned around said food plot, I think you'd find it surprisingly beneficial. I don't know much about the cover on your property. People who get pretty serious about habitat are worried about everything from bedding cover to escape cover to food plots, water sources, and so forth. I can only tell you that we have a very dedicated bow hunter using the farm that we gun hunt on now, and he's gone to great lengths to put in a couple food plots, mostly with brassicas and turnips and so forth. And holy cow, the deer really use it, and the trail cameras suggest that that's become quite an attraction, where in the driftless area in the southwestern part of the state, the agricultural crops you mentioned are a little more widely scattered. So, again, depending on the circumstances, I think a food plot has a lot of potential to bring deer into harvestable range and allow you to see them a little better and a little more consistently. And there are some really good sources of information. The Quality Deer Management Association and their magazine, Quality Whitetails, every edition usually has an article on something to do with food plots, ranging from cultivation, fertilization, planting, crops for different parts of the country. There are also a couple of good books they sell through their bookstore on food plots in a very general sense. So I think it's something. Let me put it this way. If I were fortunate enough to own a good-sized piece of deer hunting ground, I would be working with a couple of food plots, just because for one reason, I like to garden and grow stuff, and I would like to experiment with things and see how the deer responded. So, yes, okay. Mark, I think it's something you ought to look into.
And if it works, let us know. Let's go to Jim in Lisbon. He's got another question about deer. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a couple questions to Bowen. I'd like to say that the food plots really work. I have 120 acres. Even the bears come to the food plot.
Oh, Jim, we're actually, you're kind of going in and out a little bit. I don't know if you're on a cell phone, if you could get a little better reception.
You hear me now?
That's a little better. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Question I had is this new registration system. We think, and it's anecdotal at best, that perhaps the violators are going to be having a field day, because we're having a lot of shots at night during bow season, and mm-hmm. without having to take the deer into be physically registered with someone looking at the carcass, the potential for abuse is there, that they shoot a deer with a rifle, register over the phone or the internet, and they're home free.
Well, Jim, I share your concern. I think a lot of people share that concern and voiced it when we saw the mandatory registration, on-site registration, disappear last year in favor of now going to all electronic. There are certainly some convenience aspects of the electronic registration. My personal issue was not with the convenience. I just found going to the registration station, because I knew a lot of the DNR people involved, it was part of the experience for my son and I to, you know, go and kind of shoot the bull with the folks and see what other people were bringing in for deer, and it was part of the deal. I think that will pass with time and people will get used to the electronic registration. I agree that the potential is there. I have no idea, however, what kind of abuse the system is experiencing or will experience. That's up for the law enforcement people to figure out. We have a great warden force, and I suspect they're working on this. That's about all I can say about it. I hope it's not the problem that it probably could be. So.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you for your call, Jim.
I did find a neat little trick yesterday. As one of the earlier callers described, the license or the tags that we now print are just on printer paper, like this stuff.
Okay.
And, you know, how that's going to hold up in the weather or in your pocket, you know, out there dragging a deer and getting sweaty and whatnot. Anyway, I just pilfered the luggage tags off of a bunch of our suitcases, and the printer paper tags
slide inside.
Right into a luggage tag, and then you've immediately got the little strap to put around an antler or an ear or whatnot. That's what we're going to try this year. So,
well, that's a great idea.
Seems to be a neat little idea.
Yeah, well,
so
that makes total sense, and we always have some of those waiting around I'm sure we could use. Well, good luck, Jim, and let's go to John in Viroqua. Hi, John.
Hello. Hello, Scott. It's good to hear you.
Thank you.
I have a question about hunters and whether or not people are using more non-toxic ammunition for hunting species other than waterfowl. It seems that we've had, I don't know, what, 30 years of non-toxic shot for waterfowl, and it seems to me that hunters should be considering whether or not introducing just more lead into the environment is a good thing to do, a good example for others. Since we think of ourselves as conservationists and often environmentalists, are people taking advantage of the non-toxic ammunition for other species of waterfowl out there?
Yes, it's mandated for waterfowl hunting, has been for a long time. Steel shot or non-toxic shot is also mandated for dove hunting on public lands around those sunflower fields, the DNR plants. And I've run into increasing numbers of deer hunters, including me for the first time this year, who are buying solid copper bullets, like Barnes bullets. There are many different kinds of alternatives available, but we've gone to a monolithic copper bullet just because I think it's happening slowly, but eventually lead will disappear. There's a lot of it on the market. There are a variety of reasons why people are sometimes resistant to the change, but if you've seen some of the experiments of how a lead bullet fragments in a deer, for example, and how the tiny, tiny, almost invisible particles of lead distribute quite a surprising distance from the actual wound or wound tract, it becomes less of a matter of introducing lead into the environment and more a matter of introducing lead into you. So that those kinds of demonstrations can be very very compelling, and yes, people are moving slowly but steadily toward non-toxic alternatives.
Okay, thank you for that question, John. Let's go to Gary in Lodi. Hi, Gary.
Hi, yes. About a month ago, my wife saw a Canadian lynx just north of Madison near Lodi, and I just wondered if...
You don't believe her, do you?
Well... The thing is, about a year ago, she said she saw a snowy owl, and I didn't believe her, and then she had a picture of it. So.
Well, let me put it this way, Gary. The snowy owl situation is many, many, many times more likely than the lynx. Most of the time, depending on what's going on way to the north of Wisconsin, there may be years when there are no lynx, period, in the state. I don't know what the situation has been the last few years, but especially as far south as Lodi, a wild cat, I mean, the probability is just so far in favor of bobcat that it's hard to describe. A lynx would be just an incredibly long shot. Now, I learned a long, long time ago in this profession and on this show in particular to never say never about anything. We've had some weird stuff turn up, and stuff sometimes gets away from people who have them in captivity for whatever reason. We had a wolverine on Beaver Dam Lake on the ice 25 years ago, and holy cow, no, there are no wolverines in the state. Well, here's the picture, and that was eventually traced to a game farm. So weird stuff can happen, but a bob-tailed cat in the southern part of the state, even bobcats a little unusual around Lodi, but much, much more likely than a lynx.
Okay, well, you have her get a picture done, and then we'll all know for sure. Okay. Scott, you wanted to talk a little bit about it's winter. Well, it's sort of going to be winter. Eventually it's going to be winter. But, we have to worry about all wildlife and what they can do to our property.
Yeah, this is the time of year when people are out eventually, you know, cleaning up leaves and getting garden debris out and just kind of proofing their house as we kind of go from the transition of fall to winter eventually. And it is an excellent time to look your house over from the sill plate where the house joins the foundation all the way to the chimneys. You know, some people don't want to scramble around on their roof, but anything you can do to check potential access points for critters. It can be squirrels. It can be mice. It can be a raccoon, a variety of things depending on the structural integrity of the house. And now's the time to take steps to close those up, board those up, seal them up with material from hardware cloth to professional restoration, because if those animals get in over winter, they can be very destructive. The bigger stuff's fairly easy to exclude. Stuff that might get into the chimney or flue can be excluded with an animal-proof chimney cap that's probably best professionally installed. But the big pain in the neck are mice. What most people call field mice, but the little white-bellied native mice in the genus Paramiscus, there are three subspecies or species. They're indistinguishable to most people. Basically, it's a cute little white-bellied mouse, and it's in your house mm-hmm. where you don't want it. And they will chew on and wreck a lot of stuff. They're in there for winter shelter, and it doesn't take a hole but maybe the size of a dime to let them in. So it requires a meticulous search. But I think the main thing is to intercept them inside with an array of mouse traps, glue boards, whatever floats your boat as far as control, but intercept them as they're getting in and try to not let them get established in there for the winter, because I open up something of my hunting clothes and all of a sudden, oh, my favorite hat is just a pile of fuzz
yep.
where they've shredded it into a nest. And it's very annoying. So watch out for the mice outside. Protect your landscape plants, your fruit trees with hardware cloth cylinders, tree guards, fencing. Otherwise, the deer, rabbits, and other browsing animals will raise cane with those. So now's the time to do it. Not wait until spring and say, oh my gosh, I should have protected that my prize burning bush because now it's just a heap of twigs. So.
And now's the time to do it, and don't be fooled by this nice weather. There is cold weather coming, and the mice do know that, right?
Yeah, they've already started moving in, so I'll be working
noticed
on
that too.
Soon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go back to the phones real quick. We have Bonnie in Madison. She has a question for you. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Yes, I'm just calling to... Well, a few months ago, my dog and I were walking over by the post office on off of Milwaukee Street, and there's a sanctuary out there. Mm-hmm. And we came across a dead animal, and it was very unusual, and it looked like a ferret to me, but then it obviously wasn't a ferret. And then I had showed it to a few other people because I went back because it was just, I was so curious, and they didn't know what it was either, and then my daughter looked it up, and it appeared to be a fisher. So I was wondering if it's possible that there are fisher here in Madison now, and why.
So, Bonnie, it was long and skinny.
Yes.
Kind of cylindrical. Was it, what color was it?
Oh, dark brown and...
Did it have any markings on its belly or on its throat? Like a white or cream-colored spot on its throat.
Yes, and it had like a little black mask, you know, like that. But it was just so
and
beautiful.
And its tail, and the fur was very pretty and luxurious, kind of like a mink stole or something like that.
Exactly. Mm.
Well, that's probably because it was a mink. That's certainly the most likely alternative. And a good-sized mink can be... Yeah, pretty large animal, you know, 18, 20, 24 inches long maybe. But a fisher is quite a bit larger than that, bigger, much bigger than a house cat. And also, although there have been some records of fishers in the southern part of the state recently, it's a Northwoods animal. So in that kind of an urban setting, I mean, there are mink along the lakeshore path here on Lake Mendota on campus. So my bet is on mink.
Okay, well... That's what you got there, Bonnie. Thank you for calling. Scott, let's talk a little bit about taxidermy. You wanted to talk about that because you've mentioned it before. What's the update on that?
Well, months ago, Larry and I discussed the idea that, hey, there's lots of people who have called me over the years with grandpa's mounted specimens that are sitting in the basement, and boy, we don't want to dust them anymore. Or, gee, I'm moving into a smaller house, that moose head in the living room just isn't going to fit. And on the other side of the coin, nature centers and educational facilities, the zoos and whatnot, that could use this kind of stuff. Call and say, gee, if you ever hear of any stuff available, we could use it. So we thought about, well, we'll mention this on the radio, and I'd kind of act as a broker for willing donors and anxious recipients. And I wasn't sure it would go anywhere, but there was a big flurry of activity after we talked about it. And apparently these programs are somehow archived
they
so
are.
That people can find them. And just in the last couple of weeks, now 6 or 8 months after the fact, I've had two more collections come up where people in the state have contacted me, usually by email, and said, hey, I've got, in the last one, was some African big game, and there's muskies and all sorts of stuff. And if these are nicely done and have been well taken care of, taxidermy can be very expensive if it's done well. And it needs to be done well in order to be useful, because if it's not done well, it doesn't look much like the animal
right.
that they started out with. So anyway, we've put some people in touch with other people, and stuff has been distributed and used, but now there'll be another round of that. So for anybody listening who contacted me as a willing recipient, I have a file with your names, and I'll be getting out some information over the next few days. But I guess I just, you know, offer up again, if you've got something lying around the house that you're wondering what the heck I'm going to do with this, donated to a school or nature center or whatnot, I think there's probably a, you know, a tax break for the donation, and the stuff is relatively easy to value. So I guess the bottom line is we're still in the business here. So,
and how would they contact you, Scott?
I guess the best thing to do is, I mean, they can go through Larry's Facebook page, I guess, or some people have been emailing me directly at my university address, which is srcraven@wisc.edu. So,
okay.
There are various ways to track me down, but we'll try and get this stuff. Sometimes it's hard. The water buffalo is over near Green Bay, but the place that wants it is over near Eau Claire. But we can work around that.
We can work it out. Okay.
Okay.
Great. And then the other thing you wanted to chat about real quick before we have to go is you won't be here until January again. So
right.
You want to talk a little bit about holiday gift giving.
Well, you know, every year about this time, Larry and I usually talk about, you know, what's out there for the gift giving season. And when you're talking about outdoor equipment in the line of hunting, fishing, hiking, camping, whatever, all you really need to do is look at the Cabela's or Bass Pro or Gander Mountain websites, and there are thousands of possibilities. I don't think you can go wrong with, we've talked before in the program that everybody should have a set of field guides. Field guide to the mammals, field guide to the birds, field guide to the reptiles and amphibians, the Peterson field guide series or whatever one you like. Those always make a good gift. Memberships in our various conservation organizations, Rough Grouse Society, Pheasants Forever, there are dozens of them. They all do good work, and they all benefit conservation, and a membership can get an outdoors person involved in an organization. Mm-hmm. Hey, it may be something they spend the rest of their life working with.
For somebody who has everything, so that
right,
would be a really
right.
good gift for that.
Subscriptions to the various magazines and things that are available. Wisconsin Sportsman Magazine, Outdoor News came up several times. Dan Small is a contributing editor, has a wealth of information on what's going on. Box of ammunition. You know, for people
yeah.
who are concerned about non-toxic shot, give your hunting friend, find out what caliber rifle they use, and give them a box of copper ammunition. It gets expensive. And, you know, there are from clothing to knives, gift cards, a ton of stuff. Knock yourself out, folks, but it's for people who enjoy the outdoors, a gift like that is very welcome.
Great idea, Scott. Thank you again for stopping by. You're always giving us so much information. We've been talking with Scott Craven. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I want to thank Cheryl Gasser for our on-air production and Dave Potras for technical direction. Tomorrow at this time, our consumer protection experts will be back to talk about how to safely shop for the holidays and what scams are making the rounds. Hope you can join us for that. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Make sure that you come back again tomorrow. We're going to have Garden Talk. And Liz Fremont will be here from the Garden Ho. We want to thank you so much for joining us. There's lots more to come. Here comes the news.